This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, this is a great one for book lovers. Coming up in the second half, we hear from author Jill Condell about her book, The Clean Daughter, as it explores cultural differences and the approach to legalized euthanasia. But we are going to start with Jason Bourne. He is back in The Bourne Sacrifice. We're visiting now with author Brian Freeman, who took over the series some years ago. Of course, it was started famously by the late Robert Ludlum. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, Brian, I almost skipped a party that I was hosting so that I could stay and finish reading this book. You did it again.
Well, thank you. That's always my goal. You know, I want you to sit down there with a bag of Doritos and just a couple minutes to get in a few chapters. And all of a sudden it's 3 a.m. and the Doritos are long gone. And you're like, what happened to that night?
Well, there are a couple of cherry stains on this book. So just a little healthier than Doritos, but the same approach. I ate, I think, a whole bag of cherries. So this is your third book in the series. And there are three of the original trilogy. And then it was taken over by a different author. Set us up with how you describe this book.
Yeah, the Bourne Sacrifice, this is my third in the Bourne series. It started for me with the Bourne Evolution 2 years ago and then the Bourne Treachery last summer. And I basically rebooted the Bourne series. The Bourne goes all the way back to 1980 and Robert Ludlum's original book, The Bourne Identity. And there have been so many iterations of Bourne over the years between books and movies that I talked to the folks at the estate and at Putnam about essentially bringing this authentic Ludlum character forward, but dropping him down into a modern setting so that it's sort of like starting the series all over. It's all new characters, all new plots, and hopefully they feel kind of ripped from the headlines. That's certainly true of The Bourne Sacrifice.
A bit prescient to focus in on Russian aggression.
Russian aggression and media conspiracies and deep fake videos and cancel culture, we get all those in there.
Yeah, let's talk about the deep fake, because that is truly one of the most terrifying parts of the book. Now, for people who are not familiar with the deep fake, this is hackers who are able to take images and sound and make it look for all the world like someone, usually someone famous, usually someone, you know, wielding a lot of power politically or, you know, sometimes just in the celebrity world, and make it look like they said or did something that, you know, they did not. And it's happening. I saw somebody manipulate a speech from then President Obama, and I could not tell the original from the fake.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. I remember probably a couple years ago, I can't remember if it was on Instagram or TikTok, I saw kind of a fun thing where someone had taken clips from famous movies and they'd swapped out the original actor for their own face, and it looked for all the world like they were acting in these movies. And of course, you think about, oh, that's so funny, and everyone's laughing, but then you take another beat and you think, huh, exactly what could people do with this that's not so fun.
Yeah. You put that in the hands of someone who is a suspense novelist, and suddenly it's very chilling what people can and will do to destroy someone's life or career. And very much this book explores kind of the morality and this idea of the ends justify the means. And I don't want to give away too many plot points here, but what is it about the theme of the ends justify the means that really resonates with you, Brian Freeman?
You know, I think that really goes back to the approach that Ludlum took in so many of his books years ago. I mean, Ludlum knew the power of conspiracies to rile people up and bring in readers. And he wrote a lot of his books coming out of the 1970s era of Vietnam and Watergate, when there was a lot of distrust of government and a lot of unrest in the country. And bringing Jason Bourne back in the current era, honestly feels like there are a lot of parallels. And so when you start looking at what's going on in the world, it's very easy to think about how people go into situations with good intentions, and yet those intentions can be warped for much darker purposes. And in this book, it's the kind of thing that Bourne struggles with as well, because he looks at how the mainstream media in this book is sort of being corrupted by these outside influences. But he also knows that there have certainly been a lot of missions in which he's been forced to be in the same situation of the ends supposedly justifying the means.
Well, and Jason Bourne quite famously doesn't have a memory of, you know, how he came to be Jason Bourne, this highly trained assassin, spy. Some people try to make him, you know, on the quote-unquote good side. Some people say he, you know, came from the dark side. So, again, at the core of this book is this, you know, search for identity and the truth. And when you look at the word the truth and all of the manipulation that happens to Jason Bourne, what does the word truth mean to a suspense novelist?
Yeah, it's awfully hard to it's awfully hard to nail down what's real and what's not. There are an awful lot of shades of gray in the world, and one of the themes in The Bourne Sacrifice is to actually go back to another of Robert Ludlum's book, a novel called The Chancellor Manuscript, which is one of my favorite novels growing up and reading Ludlum's books as a teenager. And Peter Chancellor is a thriller writer, and he writes fiction that feels as if it could be true, and maybe, and it asks readers to think, well, maybe it actually happened that way. So I had a little fun bringing Peter Chancellor back into The Bourne Sacrifice, and it gets back to that that question that sometimes novels actually feel closer to the truth than nonfiction does. And so I had a little bit of fun with that concept in The Bourne Sacrifice, because suddenly this thriller writer who's writing fiction gets pulled into what is supposedly the reality of this conspiracy.
Well, yeah, this Peter Chancellor guy, he is writing a lot of books, exactly like you said, conspiracy theories, pointing out stuff that it seems like he should have no business knowing, even under the guise of it being fiction. Now, he is a thriller novelist who is writing conspiracy books. You probably know where I'm going with
there's Brian. There's layers within layers here, aren't there? Yeah.
Yeah, but are you trying to tell us that, you know, you're this guy? Maybe you're, you know, Genesis. You're the guy everyone's after.
Well, you got to wonder. You got to wonder.
This could be it. This could be the ultimate deep fake. Your cover story goes back a long time now at this point, Brian.
Well, I confess, I always do wonder when those mysterious folks at the NSA are looking through Google searches, when they come upon mine, I always figure they must sort of do a double take and think, why is this person searching for some of these things?
Okay, like what?
Oh, all sorts of explosives and guns and terrorism and all these kinds of things. And I think it probably gets flagged for further attention, and it goes to somebody's desk and they say, oh yeah, that's just for you.
That's just that guy. Have you ever been, brought aside? Customs and border control, like, oh.
not yet, but I figure I better start bringing a copy of my books along on trips just to be sure.
Well, and the latest book just out this week is called The Bourne Sacrifice. Author Brian Freeman, of course, bringing Jason Bourne back to life in The Bourne Evolution, The Bourne Treachery, The Bourne Sacrifice. You're coming out with once a year here. How are you keeping up?
Yeah, it's kind of a busy year, because here we have, you know, The Bourne Sacrifice out now. I already had The Ursulina out earlier this year, which was a follow-up to my Edgar Award finalist, The Deep, Deep Snow. And then there are two more coming out in the next few months. A standalone thriller called I Remember You comes out in a couple of weeks. And then the 11th in my long-running Jonathan Stride series set in Duluth, a book called The Zero Night. That'll be coming out November 1st. So, yeah, they're keeping me hopping.
Yeah, we had you on. You can check the Main Street Archives page to listen to the conversation about the Ursulina. And we'll have you back on in early August to talk about I Remember You, which I have also already read and quite enjoyed. And then now this Jonathan Stride novel. Do you ever have trouble keeping the characters from the different books that you write, you know, in line? I know you do some crossovers.
Yeah, that's a good question. A couple of years ago, I was writing a Jason Bourne novel and a Jonathan Stride novel simultaneously. I would do a week on one and then a week on the other because the deadlines were so close. And I needed to be kind of cautious that Stride suddenly didn't start pulling out a gun and handling things the Bourne way. So.
Well, are these deadlines? I mean, are they coming from you and you're just, you know, an artist and a creative who has to work under a deadline, or are these coming from the publishing companies?
Yeah, it's coming from the publishers, and I work with several different publishers on different types of books, and so it sometimes it just happens that the deadlines end up pretty close together, and so I wind up working on a couple different projects simultaneously.
Yeah. What does happen to an author if a deadline is missed? It does happen.
I suppose it does happen. I'm unfortunately for me, it's been a theoretical question up until now because I've always hit the deadline. But the Bourne Sacrifice, this has been, I think, the fastest novel I ever wrote. It was due at the end of January, and as of early December, I had about 20,000 words written, okay. And so I wrote about 80,000 words in 6 weeks, which was the most propulsive writing task I've ever had in my life. And wow. Yet, you know, for Jason Bourne. It kind of works because Bourne is a propulsive hero, and I think it really has that sense of energy and breathlessness as you go through the book.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this before in your other Bourne books that have come out, but this technique that you have of, you know, this is Brian Freeman's version of Jason Bourne, but paying homage to Robert Ludlum, even things like just having exclamation points in the book and some throwbacks to Ludlum's style, but still while keeping, you know, your fingerprint on it. What's your approach to that?
Yeah, you know, Ludlum had such a distinctive dramatic style. It was very, again, very kind of a breathless prose style that was so clearly his own stamp. And I think if you tried to imitate that, it would end up feeling like a caricature. So what I've tried to do is sort of allow echoes of the Ludlum style into my own style. And I think what comes out of it is something new. It's a little bit of a mélange of Ludlum's approach and my approach. So I think it feels like a Ludlum novel. And I hope, you know, Ludlum fans and lovers can sense that in the book. And yet it also feels, you know, authentic and grounded in, you know, in a real prose style, not just like I'm trying to imitate how Ludlum used to write.
Well, and, you know, the last sentence in this book indicates there will be another Jason Bourne novel. What are you going to tell us about that?
Yeah, the Bourne Sacrifice definitely sort of leads right into the fourth Bourne novel, and in fact, I'm already 90% of the way through writing the Bourne Defiance. I wasn't taking any chances on having to do this sprint again come Christmas time. So I'm almost done with the next book. It should be out next summer, the Bourne Defiance, and it brings a lot of the threads from the first three books together, and it kind of starts to tie them all up.
Yeah, well. Defiance is quite a strong word.
Well, we always have to come up with a good strong Bourne word here. So treachery and sacrifice, yeah. And defiance.
Well, I look forward to reading that book and figure out exactly who is being defiant. And typically, I figure it out on about the second to last page. You know, as is often the case. We are visiting today with Brian Freeman. His latest book is called The Bourne Sacrifice. This is the third Brian Freeman installment in the Jason Bourne books, The Bourne Evolution, The Bourne Treachery, and then, like I said, now out this week is The Bourne Sacrifice. Brian, have any spies or professional assassins that you are aware of read your books?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I've certainly had a fair number of military covert ops people that have chimed in from time to time, and I always love that. I'm always honored when folks like that read my books, and you know, I know I'm writing fiction, and they live in a very different world, but I enjoy the idea that something I'm doing can give them a little entertainment.
Well, I like the idea of maybe they would write a blurb for the book.
There we go. Of course, they'd probably have to remain anonymous on who's giving
yeah,
it. So.
I mean, you'd think. But those military and covert ops people who are reading the book, is this just, like you said, fiction, passing the time, fun for them? Or are they ever kind of weighing in on, dude, that just would not happen? You're way over Hollywooding this.
Yeah, I think if I pushed it too far, I'd probably get a little pushback. On the other hand, I know that you know, all these folks really enjoy kind of you know, books that take it to the dramatic extreme. I certainly hear from a lot of police detectives when a new Jonathan Stride novel comes out, and they love following Stride's exploits. And I don't know, I think there may be a little bit of wish fulfillment that you know, they'd love to be able to handle things the way Stride does.
Well, give us a little preview about what's coming up in the Jonathan Stride novel, because there is a lot happening that is quite interesting in the world of being a police detective right now, just in face of what's happening with Black Lives Matter and Native American Lives Matter movements, and even a couple of police departments in Minnesota, where you live, have had to close down and get sheriffs coming in to take over small town. And I'm sure you're not really going into that level, but give us a preview of what Jonathan Stride is facing in the world of policing.
Yeah, in The Zero Night, that comes out November 1st. This follows on the heels of my last Stride novel, Funeral for a Friend, which came out 2 years ago, and that was a tough novel for Stride. Some very difficult things happened to him, and he wound up on medical leave from the police force in Duluth. And now he's kind of at that crossroads in his life of does he retire, or does he want to kind of dive back into the darkness of that world and start dealing with the criminals and the lies again? And so naturally a mystery surfaces where his old partner Maggie thinks that he should get back on the force, and so that's kind of the decision point for Stride is what's going to happen next in his life, and can he go back to what he had left behind?
Ooh, sounds fascinating. I'm curious too, Brian, in working with different publishing companies for the different novels that you put out there, just characterize, are they very similar in their approaches to editing and you know, first drafts and everything? I know your wife is always your first reader, but
sure.
In the different publishing companies, are they vastly different approaches to getting a book published?
In a lot of ways, yeah, they are. It not necessarily so much from an editorial standpoint, but each publishing company kind of has their different approach to the marketplace, and it's actually been one of the fun things for me is the opportunity to work with different places that have kind of a very different focus on the market. And so, you know, the Bourne books are put out by Putnam, which is one of the largest publishing houses in the country, and they have kind of a you know, a very traditional approach to the book publishing world. My Stride novels are published by Blackstone, which is kind of a newcomer. They've been an audio publisher for years and years, but they got into the print and ebook world just a few years ago, and they've been a very exciting publisher to work with, and they've really been trying kind of some new marketing approaches, and still building on, you know, their experience in audio as well. And speaking of audio, I've done Audible originals where they're specifically aimed at the audio market, and then I Remember You is coming out from Thomas and Mercer, which is an affiliate of Amazon Publishing, and so even though they do other formats for their books, they're very heavily focused on the ebook world. So how the book gets out to readers varies a lot from publisher to publisher.
Yeah, it's interesting that you don't end up having to sign any kind of non-compete.
Yeah, there's usually a clause in every author's contract about sort of not you know, stepping on the toes of other publishers. Mine get very complex because when you've got four books coming out in a year, it gets a little tricky trying to make sure that everyone kind of has their own day in the sun.
Brian Freeman's latest book is called The Born Sacrifice. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Tommy Zern is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Cottonwood Bluegrass Band invites you to the 10th Annual Bluegrass Goes Pink, a fundraiser benefiting the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation on Saturday, July 30th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. You can start your morning with a fun 5 or 10K walk or run on the scenic trails of Cross Ranch. Then supper will be served by the Washburn Churches at 5 and a concert by Cottonwood Bluegrass Band at 7 p.m. Wear pink and enjoy some bluegrass and support cancer awareness with Bluegrass Goes Pink, July 30th. More information online at cottonwoodbluegrass.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and there are lots of sources historians consult, from newspapers to folk songs. Here's this week's Plains Folk essay with historian Tommy Zern, Just the Place for Me.
Without doubt, the most famous song of the Dust Bowl is Woody Guthrie's ballad, Dust Bowl Disaster. Writing from the vantage of Pampa, Texas, he sings, "On the 14th day of April in 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky." Guthrie's song, an adaptation of older cyclone ballads from Texas, is a true and telling depiction of a natural and social disaster. Psychologists and historians agree, however, that adults and children experience the same situations differently. This is why it is so fascinating to find a Dust Bowl ballad written by a 13-year-old girl in western Kansas. In late April of 1937, the Fairview Enterprise published the lengthy poem, Just the Place for Me, by Gretchen Gildehaus. Although Fairview is in northeast Kansas, the epistle came from Dodge City in the southwest. Notes the editor, "The following is a poem written by Gretchen Gildehaus, 13, to her grandmother, Mrs. George Gildehaus. The poem was written while Gretchen was watching a dust storm during her visit with her aunt at Dodge City." These circumstances add additional perspective to the stanzas. Gretchen was the daughter of Earl and Maud Gildehaus, who lived in several different places in the Northeast, where Earl practiced his trade as a garage man. Summers, they sent Gretchen to Dodge to stay with her aunt, her mother's sister, I believe. We might think that coming from green Fairview to dusty Dodge, Gretchen might be repulsed, but not so at all. She found the Western country and its citizens fascinating. Of her Western sojourn, she writes, "I'm a-going to the bright and the sunny west, back to the place I love the best, where the sagebrush and the cactus grows. How I love it no one knows. I'm going to go back to the place where there's very few trees and plenty of space. Very few trees and plenty of space. That's just a place for me." And so every stanza ends, "That's just a place for me." It's sort of obligatory for a girl's ballad to comment on the habits of the male gender. Gretchen observes, "Most all the men wear broad-brimmed hats. They don't clean their feet on the wool doormats, but they wash their feet in a big cow tank where all the cattle and the horses drank." Her life in Dodge, it seems, is full of wonders, and she is undaunted by the dust storms, however they may alarm the tourists. After many false promises of rain, "Then comes a little cloud, it rains without trying, and it makes the folks all feel like flying. It makes the folks all feel like flying. That's just a place for me." I suspect that young Gretchen's annual visit was like a nice summer rain for her kin out west. So next week, I'll give you another 13-year-old voice from the dusty 1930s, that of a boy from Burley County, North Dakota.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, a conversation with a one-book, one North Dakota author. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Xcel Energy is proposing a new energy transmission line that would be about 140 miles long and run across southern Minnesota. The new line would use some of Xcel's existing infrastructure. Michael Lamb is Xcel's senior vice president for transmission. He says the new power line will allow for more wind and solar power.
It's a giant piece of our ability to meet our carbon reduction goals. It's not the only thing, but it is a big piece of our strategy to achieve those objectives.
The company is now contacting landowners and local governments before drawing up route plans. It will file a certificate of need application with Minnesota regulators later this year. If that's approved, Xcel expects to complete the project in 2028. Xcel is also proposing a $500 million transmission line in western Minnesota. Low-income families in North Dakota may qualify for assistance in repairing or purchasing air conditioners or other cooling devices to beat the heat this summer. Robin Addington is program administrator for LIHEAP, which stands for Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which helps families pay for heating in the winter. She says this year's cooling program is available for those who have previously qualified for LIHEAP.
So in order to qualify, they have to qualify financially for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. And so, for example, like we can serve households with incomes up to 60% of the state median. So, for example, a family of two, that would equate to around $42,467 a year. In order to qualify for cooling, they would need to apply for the cooling program if they were not already on LIHEAP this past season.
LIHEAP is federally funded. The cooling assistance program was approved by Congress as part of COVID-19 relief. Last year, 426 households in North Dakota qualified for cooling assistance. And Bison fans are closer than ever to being able to enjoy a cold beer during Bison football games starting this fall. The Fargo Dome Authority has voted to approve beer sales during Bison football games, sending the agreement back to NDSU Athletics to wrap up some final details. Both sides have to sign off on the revised lease agreement before it is a done deal, and that is expected in a couple of weeks. Fargo Dome General Manager Rob Soblick said Dome staff will make sure beer sales will be made to those of legal age and are in compliance with city server training.
We have a lot of policies in place already because we do sell alcohol at the majority of our other events, but this is something new, and I think people have seen how people react to new things. This is one of the things that when we do start selling alcohol, I think it is going to be something that's monitored pretty closely by a lot of different groups just to see how it's going and making sure that people are doing it responsibly and in the proper way.
The beer sales will be on a one-year trial basis at the football games. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 66 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, it's another 10 Things episode with Clay Jenkinson and Lindsay Chervinsky. And Clay, this one's a little different.
A listener sent me a letter asking us to wrestle with some of the paradoxes and inconsistencies of Jefferson's life, of course, chiefly the problem of slavery and Thomas Jefferson.
He also asked why a guy like Jefferson, who kept such meticulous records, could never get his own personal finances under control.
He reduced the national debt by about half, but he wasn't able to manage his private finances, and as we all know, Jefferson died helplessly in debt.
Lindsay Chervinsky has a very interesting perspective on these things.
Not particularly enamored of our favorite man, Mr. Jefferson, and willing to speak to some of the paradoxes that have been glided over by previous historians.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and right now we are going to preview a conversation that will air in full on Sunday. It is between Director of Radio Bill Thomas and author Jill Condell about her book, The Clean Daughter, chosen earlier this year as part of the One Book, One North Dakota series from Humanities ND. Jill Condell is from North Dakota, but she has lived in parts of Africa, and her husband is Dutch. And she explores cultural differences towards euthanasia in the book.
Jill Condell married a Netherlander, and some of the resulting experiences are what this book, The Clean Daughter, is about. Some are warm and light. Others are deathly serious, literally. You should be aware that assisted suicide and euthanasia come up. But we'll start with when I asked Jill about her own background.
I grew up in Valley City, spent my whole life there till I went away to college, so attended Valley City High School, and then went to Mary College. So I'm a homegrown North Dakota girl. My grandparents were all immigrants, on one side from my father from Denmark, and on the other side from my mom, they were German-Russian. So I remember being a child and going out to Western North Dakota a lot for holidays and kind of consider North Dakota and the prairie my home. Actually, I've always been a reader, and one of my very favorite memories growing up is going to the Valley City Carnegie Library and spending all day Saturday there. I think the librarians were amazing. So read my entire life, loved books, but started writing at the age of 40.
I asked Jill Condell if she would read from the prologue of her book, which sets up things pretty well.
When I fall in love with and marry a man from the Netherlands, my blue-eyed boy, I get a new name and a new family, a Dutch family. I also become, for the first time in my life, a daughter-in-law, or as the Dutch say, schoondochter, a compound word that, if taken apart and parsed literally, would become clean daughter. I marry in the Netherlands in a ceremony presided over by my newly acquired father-in-law, Isaac. He's wearing his long black pastoral robe. Father-in-law in Dutch, schoonvader, clean father. Mother-in-law, schoonmoeder, clean mother. We're all very clean and fresh to this new joining, this cross-continental family that we are creating. This joining will permeate my existence for years to come, as Johan and I work with subsistence farmers in remote areas around the globe. As my North Dakota prairie life, solid beneath my feet for as long as I can remember, shifts and tilts. In the early 1980s, when Johan and I marry, the number of intermarried newlyweds, those with partners of differing ethnicity or race, make up 5% of the marriages in the United States. But I'm not living in a progressive coastal city. My hometown, set in the middle of the United States and a few hours' drive away from the Canadian border, has a population of less than 8,000. I don't have a single friend married to a person from another country. Every marriage has its own challenges. A cross-cultural marriage, even more so. But a cross-cultural marriage that seeks to live and work in a third culture might verge on being foolhardy. Johan and I look homogeneous. We're both light-colored skin, light blue eyes and gray, tallish, slender. You'd never guess from looking at us, walking hand in hand down any street, that we grew up in countries 4,000 miles apart, separated by the stormy Atlantic. Our appearance a camouflage that hides our vast cultural differences. We grew up with different languages, music, literature, and traditions. We relish different foods, celebrate distinct holidays, follow divergent customs, and respected different laws and rules. Our reference points barely even coincided, although we both grew up attending church, Lutheran and Dutch Reformed. We had our faith in common and our ideals. He wanted to feed the world, and I wanted to help him accomplish his ambition. If I had told you, as a 15-year-old, riding my Appaloosa across the hills of North Dakota, that someday I'd honeymoon on the North Sea of the Netherlands, I'd have thought you were being ridiculous. If you'd said my mother-in-law and father-in-law would speak a different language than I did, I'd have thought you were joking. If you'd have told me euthanasia laws enacted in another country would affect me personally, I would have laughed incredulous. I'm not laughing anymore. Looking back, I can hardly believe how naive I was. I didn't even think to ask relevant questions about marriage, let alone about the vast differences in our lifestyles and our paths. Where would we settle? How often will I get to see my friends and family? If we have children, what passport will they carry? What citizenship? What language will we speak in our home? If we mix our languages, his and mine, of the various countries we reside in, how will I handle the endless misinterpretations, miscommunications, the never-ending struggle to speak a word when I can't find a word, the frustration inherent in having different mother tongues? When I speak Dutch, I'll always sound like an American. When Johan speaks English, his accent will forever give him away. His tone, the very cadence of his words, mark him as other than a native English speaker. One day Johan says to me, "Jill, you're so small-hearted." I'm offended. Then he's offended that I'm offended. We step back, we swallow, we each take a breath and ask for clarification. Small-hearted is the Dutch way of saying big-hearted. Your heart's so small that even the tiniest of things will move it. He's giving me a compliment, and it takes a minor blow-up before I can hear it. By the time I do, the compliment's been lost. Word after word, day after day, year after year. Even after I think I've learned it all, we're still wading through a no-man's land of linguistic perils. And it's not just my husband. There's my in-laws, too. Continental divides exist between us. How smug those Europeans can come across. How childish those Americans. How can I build a relationship with them when there are so many barriers? And what about the war that shaped their childhoods? The Nazi-occupied Netherlands imprinted into my father-in-law's personality. I'm barely even conversant in World War II. I have no idea the minefield I'm stepping into, the fear, the control, how sour a relationship can grow, how Isak's decision to die will affect my entire family for decades. Over 30 years ago, I said three words. Yes, I do. A fairy tale in the making, a soft-spoken trinity that changed everything. I stated these three words with simple, open clarity. 26 years old and kneeling in a thin white dress on the ancient floor of an old Dutch church, my father-in-law's hand heavy upon my head.
You're listening to excerpts of my conversation with Jill Condell about her book, The Clean Daughter, which is available from NDSU Press, from Jill's own website, Jill Condell, K-A-N-D-E-L, or Zambros, Ferguson Books. You can find it many places. I asked her if there had been any interesting questions about the title of the book, The Clean Daughter.
I had one person ask me, oh, were you addicted by drugs and now you're clean? No. When I was first married to Hans, to Johan, I was learning the Dutch language and I didn't know it very well. And I was called a schoondochter, which means daughter-in-law. And in my mind, I knew the word schön meant clean and the word dochter meant daughter. So I thought it meant clean daughter. So it was a linguistic mistake. But for about 20 years, I thought of myself as a clean daughter. And one day I said something to my husband about being a clean daughter, and he said, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, clean daughter, schön dochter, daughter-in-law. And he said, no Dutch person would ever think of that. And I didn't believe him. So I contacted his sister and told her, and she said, oh, that's cute. So I was considering myself to be a clean daughter for 20 years. And it's kind of representative of living life with two different languages. And Hans and I were talking about it, and he said it might be similar to if someone used the word honeymoon in English and you changed it to a lunar object and something sticky, and then you take a sticky lunar object and you translate it to another language. Like, it makes no sense at all. But here I am, the clean daughter.
As the book goes along, Jill explains how, though she gets along wonderfully with her husband, she is a bit of a mismatch with her father-in-law.
Mm-hmm. I think primarily we had very different personalities. And he was a man who was fond of prestige and protocol and punctuality and being in control. So I didn't know till after he died that being in control was his way of showing love. He wanted to protect and have things go in a way that he could control them. So I often felt kind of at loggerheads with him because he would tell me what to do and how to do. I was also new to the Dutch culture, so I didn't know a lot of things that were acceptable or not acceptable there, so I had a lot to learn. And I think being young, I didn't appreciate his way of teaching me and showing me and telling me. And so it was partly being young, and it was partly cultural differences. But we are very different people.
This all becomes particularly acute when Jill has to confront her father-in-law's decision about ending his life. Again, discussion of euthanasia and suicide ahead.
The Netherlands was the first country in the world to legalize euthanasia, and that was in 2002. And Johan's father decided that he would like to end his life. And it took 5 years, is that five? 6 years before that actually happened. There were a lot of protocols in Holland at first. You had to have a terminal diagnosis, be thought to die within a few months. You had to have unrelenting pain. And as the years went by, those things changed. So by 2008, the Netherlands allowed euthanasia for people for psychosocial reasons. So if they felt that they didn't have the lifestyle they wanted or the money they wanted or the friends they wanted, you know, they could make that choice. So when Hans's father said that he wanted to end his life, we didn't think he'd get permission, first of all, because he was still relatively healthy and living on his own and going to concerts and driving his car and cooking. And we just didn't think it would happen. So when his doctors gave him permission, I think much of the family was very surprised that it was allowed, for one thing. And he was always a very stubborn man, and he made up his mind and said, this is what I'm doing. And so part of the difficulty was there was no discussion. It was just he decided. And it was just so incredibly hard to understand. So I think we were actually quite shocked that it happened and was allowed. So that was a very pivotal point in my uneasy relationship with him. It ended badly. And for about 4 years, we didn't go back to the Netherlands. We just didn't. We weren't able to, you know. And it forced us into so many difficult decisions. What do we tell our children? We had young children. I mean, do you tell your children that their grandfather chose to die and have that discussion? In a sense, you're taking away some of their innocence. And he didn't want us talking about it. So it forced us into a sort of secrecy. So my in-laws didn't tell people that he had chosen euthanasia. And I've never been one to like secrets and keep secrets. And I just felt like if that's the choice he made, then it doesn't help anyone not to talk about it or to cover it up. So I started dreaming about him and having nightmares, and I think I started writing primarily to answer my own questions, because I was, I just didn't understand.
Jill Condell did not understand her father-in-law's decision, and the latter part of her book follows her effort to get to that understanding. That involved her digging deep into the history and rationale around euthanasia and assisted suicide. Spoiler alert, she learns a lot about that history, and she also learns some surprisingly admirable things about her father-in-law, but does not become fully reconciled to his action. Hear my whole conversation with Jill Condell this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, or look for it at prairiepublic.org.
That was Director of Radio Bill Thomas in conversation with author Jill Condell about her book, The Clean Daughter, one of Humanities ND's One Book, One North Dakota selections. The book is published by NDSU Press and is available online and in some local bookstores. Dakota Datebook is next.
Enjoy wandering through English country gardens.
You walk for about 100 yards and it's like bells of yellow flowers dropping down on you.
Cultivate one of your own.
First of all, you should not worry about whether or not you have a green thumb.
And unplug yourself for a little free time.
We are prisoners of the wired world that we have created ourselves.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves comes your way tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the recipients of the 2022 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2022 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows. Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 27th. Before the Garrison Dam was built, the Missouri was a wily river. Its greedy undercurrents had proven treacherous on several occasions. On this date in 1955, painter Donald Ryland of Newtown was working 135 feet above the river on the Four Bears Bridge when he lost his balance reaching for a paint stick. He managed to grab a steel beam, but before others could reach him, he lost his grip and fell into the rising reservoir. Ryland tried to swim, but a short distance from the shore, he went under. The river gave him up. 3 days later, about 4 miles downstream, An autopsy revealed he had no broken bones, but his fellow workers assumed he was stunned from the fall. Ryland's death was not the first at the construction site. Working at such heights was dangerous, and just 2 years before, Sylvester Marr of Minnesota fell to his death when scaffolding on one of the bridge piers collapsed. Marr and several others plummeted into the pier's cofferdam. One man, Edwin Zook, was seriously injured, breaking his shoulder. Had it not been for a carpenter near the accident, he too may have died. Zook had landed on the muddy bottom of the cofferdam with his head stuck in the mud. The carpenter, C.R. Happ, pulled him free and got him to solid ground. Merle Wilhite had fallen 80 feet but was not seriously injured. George Peltier managed to cling to a cable as the scaffolding fell. Raymond Sainar had just stepped from the section before it collapsed. Another man escaped injury when he fell into the river and was submerged long enough to avoid being hit by the collapsing scaffold. Zook, Marr, and Wilhite were taken to the hospital in Stanley, where Marr died. The old Four Bears Bridge spanning the Garrison Reservoir was just over a mile long, the longest in the state. In October 2005, it was demolished, replaced by the new Four Bears Bridge, which had been completed that September. This Dakota Datebook was written by Tessa Sandstrom. I'm Marie Offit.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Prairie Public is thrilled to bring the Moth Main Stage live storytelling event back to the Fargo Theater. The Moth is true stories told live and without notes by people from all walks of life. Experience the power of live storytelling on Thursday, December 1st. Tickets available at jadepresents.com.
Hurricanes are more intense and frequent, fueled by climate change. Rising sea levels could put more neighborhoods at risk of flooding, but developers in three big coastal cities are still building in the likely path of monster storms.
Every bit of sea level that we add to this just makes this kind of scenario would be worse.
How big is the risk? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we meet a Next Star Media Woman of the Year. Judy Pickett is a cancer survivor, a teacher, and the founder of the Pink Ribbon Running Club. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.